You make the room a little bit smaller, you can end up with a situation very similar to what you did with your small loop that was in the shack with you. You can end up steering the polarization of the antenna differently. And as such, you're radiating the same amount of power into space, I believe, but you may be doing it with a slightly different pattern. And so the guy that you used to talk to in Pennsylvania, with your outdoor loop that was full wavelength long, and then you go to a half wavelength loop, but you wrap it around twice, so electrically it's the same length, you may end up with slightly different pattern, a slightly different polarimetry. Therefore, your friend in Pennsylvania may get a stronger or a weaker signal. If he gets a weaker signal, you will say, oh, I know what's going on. It's a cloud warmer. If you believe a smaller antenna is only going to squirt the signal straight up instead of out to the horizon, if you truly believe that, then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If there happens to be a little bit of different state of the ionosphere on the day that you do that test, you say, aha, there it is. I know what it is. And you might be wrong. In the VHF world, there's a whole lot of loop antennas that are electrically very small. Whenever you listen to an FM broadcast station, a large number of FM broadcast stations are running a loop antenna that is a small fraction of a wavelength in diameter. And they stack a number of them vertically above each other so that they get a pancake pattern. But I can tell you that the FM broadcast station, radiating 10 kilowatts or 50 kilowatts of power, is using an extremely high efficiency loop antenna. To them, it is not a cloud warmer. It is light, it warms up the horizon, and they get some nice range out of their FM broadcast station. So many of the FM broadcast stations you listen to are a vertical stacking of multiple loop antennas that are a small fraction of a wavelength in diameter. So a small diameter antenna is not a cloud warmer. In fact, as the diameter of the antenna gets smaller and smaller, the amount of radiation straight up, this is a loop that is parallel to the ground. As the loop gets smaller and smaller, the amount of radiation that goes straight up and straight down goes to zero. It's the extreme opposite of being a cloud
repeater. Time out.
So I'll say it again. A small loop is the extreme opposite of being a cloud warmer. The only way it radiates is out to the horizon. So the guys who said that and they thought they made that measurement, you can tell I'm pretty skeptical now. K2KE1, K2LIW.
HWW had a comment.
Go ahead, Howie.
There was a company back in the 60s called Stinger. The antenna was called the Stinger. It was made for CB. It was a ground plane, and it was a 3-foot ground plane. The vertical was loaded, and the four elements, the four radiating elements, were loaded. And the thing did almost as well as a full-size ground plane.
Doesn't surprise me. Unless the antenna is multiple wavelengths in some dimension, it doesn't have the resources to do a substantial amount of pattern control. The majority of small antennas are dipole-like radiators. You take a small diameter loop that you resonated, and you'll find out that its pattern is very similar to a dipole pattern. And that small diameter loop, parallel to the ground, has a null in the direction straight up and down, just like a vertical dipole would have. It's the opposite of a cloud warmer. So those guys may have thought they had a cloud warmer. I'm kind of doubting it pretty strongly, Mel. Go ahead.
I guess they did an experiment of shortening it down by doubling it up, and the results didn't seem to be as good as the full wave loop in its original form. So I gave them a proposal, I should say, another way to foreshorten that loop, make it 30 feet on the side, as I was saying, with using the coils. And I did a modeling on it. It looked fairly promising. One person I know in up there in Massachusetts was anxious to put up a loop, and he has 30 feet, and that is 30 feet on the side. So he's going to go with the coil method that basically laid out. So we'll see the results of that in in this winter, things settle down, we'll get some comments from him on how it's performing, take over.
Sounds good. And the only thing I'm worried about is that this polarimetry characteristic. When he does his testing, depending on what the amount of Faraday rotation of the ionosphere is that day, and his antenna might be predominantly horizontally polarized, and if the signal he's sending from point A to point B comes into his shack as a vertically, into his QTH location as a vertically polarized signal, and he gets very little signal, he can easily come to the conclusion that during that period of time, his antenna is not performing well. The beautiful advantage you've got with that loop you've got is you can steer it in as, and L, and polarization, and you can literally peek it on the state of Faraday rotation from the ionosphere at this hour of this day. That's a beautiful adaptability. And except for those buddies of yours that you took, some of those articles you've seen where guys have run block and tackles up and down the towers with remotely controlled motors and whatever so that they can tilt their loop, except for those guys, they don't have the adaptability of your loop. And they believe a big antenna has to have a big capture area. Good common sense, dead wrong. And let me give you an example why. I'm going to start off with something we all know about. I'm pushing my son on a swing in the backyard. Assume the rope goes up to the top of the swing set, and you got a nice bearing there, so there's no loss in the system. And I give a 1 ounce push to my son each time he comes toward me on that swing. I'm giving him very little energy on each individual push. But if I do it long enough, pretty soon he's up to a pretty big deflection. That's resonance. And that is co-phase energy absorption of the child swinging on the swing, or I'm co-phase energy adding to the system. I'm pushing him at the right time, and the energy keeps adding up. He's a kind of a flywheel, if you know what I mean. Every antenna that resonates is a kind of a flywheel. It is a kind of a swing. I've told you guys many times that a full 80-meter dipole, 130 feet long, made out of any reasonable diameter wire, 14-gauge household wire, strung up in the air at 30 feet, we'll say, 50 feet altitude. That has 8,500 square feet of effective capture area. If you could see it with your eyes, the radio signal it's absorbing, you'd see this black ellipse in space where the ellipse has a horizontal dimension about 30% bigger than the wire itself in length end to end, and about one-third of that distance across top to bottom. That great big ellipse, any 80-meter horizontally polarized energy entering that black area gets absorbed by that wire, goes down the feed line, and moves the S-meter on your receiver. And you say to yourself, how the hell can that happen? The piece of wire is a 16th of an inch or an eighth of an inch in diameter. It's 14-gauge household wire. It's casting a shadow on the ground of 1 square foot approximately, and you're telling me it's got 8,500 square feet of radio capture area on transmit and on receive. How the hell can that happen? And one way of looking at it is that the energy that's coming toward the antenna, that's directly firing itself through the wire, the fact that it gets sucked up by the wire and goes down the feed line, you can accept that one. But now, that little chunk of energy that is 30 feet above the wire, that little chunk of energy, how the hell is it coupling itself into that wire 30 feet away? You'll admit that the coupling coefficient of a little chunk of energy 30 feet away into the wire is small, but it's resonant. Very similar to when you're pushing your son on that swing. You're doing it with your pinky. You're only applying an ounce of force, but you're doing it over and over again in phase. And pretty soon he builds up a pretty big deflection. Those little chunks of energy 30 feet away are exactly at the right phase over and over again on each individual cycle. And it builds up energy on that wire. The wire itself is a kind of a flywheel. When you're transmitting, that energy has to bounce back and forth 30 times before it gets radiated in space. Same thing's happening on reception. The signal is bouncing back and forth 30 times on that wire before it decides to go down into the feed line. You could say that. It's the exact opposite of transmitting. That's what the law of reciprocity is saying. So the energy coming into your backyard can be quite far away from the wire, and because it's the pinky pushing the child, so to speak, in phase, it adds up correctly. It's not exactly the physics of what's going on, but it's close. It helps. I mean, in my mind, it used to be very difficult to figure out how can that 1 square foot of wire, the shadow on the ground from the sun shining on the wire, it's only got a physical area of 1 square foot. Let me drop. And yet, it has this great big 8,500 square feet of effective area. It's because of this resonance phenomenon. The exact same amount of wire that's on the power line from Con Ed across the street, casting the exact same shadow on the ground, doesn't create that much shadow area under that antenna, because it is not resonant. The energy going past that wire doesn't get a chance to push the swing at the right in phase on each cycle, because the wire from Con Ed is not resonant. It's essentially transparent. It's casting a 1 square foot shadow onto your 8,000 square feet of antenna. So even that Con Ed wiring is directly across the street, directly in the direction of the guy you want to talk to in London. It is not there for all practical purposes. At first it seems crazy. The piece of wire from Con Ed doesn't suck up the signal. The exact same diameter of wire, or even a skinnier diameter of wire, at the exact same altitude on your property, does suck up the signal from London. How does it do that? Resonance. The disadvantage of resonance is that the antenna is narrowband. You tune a dipole for 3.5 megs, you're going to be somewhat unhappy about the visual when you use it at 4.0 if you don't readjust its length or rematch it with an antenna tuner. That's the disadvantage of resonance. But the advantage of resonance is it gives you area. The Con Ed piece of wire has no area because it doesn't resonate. Maybe that helps. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yes, very good. This is K2KEY, well. Everybody that does the antenna experiment, especially for this type of antennas, usually we know, of course, we work during the summertime, and then we do an evaluation with them over the wintertime, over the weeks and months. It's not one day to put it up and say, gee, it's either fantastic or it's a failure, and that's it. You get the clippers out of it. It's not going to, you know, one day work, first day work, the way you think it's going to work, you right away get out the cutters and start chopping away at it. No, that doesn't happen. We understand that we have different conditions, and like you said, Faraday rotation, because I surely have seen the effects of that on my receiving loop that I have in a shack that's less than 1.1 wavelength, and how the signals are different from day to day from the same station, how I tilt it, start it, you know, do all kinds of things with it. And now it's amazing how many different, different angles and all I've found the signals arriving at. It's definitely, you know, something that you have to be very patient with when you do an experiment like this and spread it out over a long period of months of evaluation before you can come to some conclusions. Go ahead.
You've got a very good point there. When you're comparing antenna A to antenna B, the only fair way to do it is make sure they got the same polarization. If you're comparing a horizontal antenna at one altitude to a vertical antenna at another altitude, you're doing a double apples orange comparison. So the antenna should be at the same altitude, same polarization. Then you stand a chance of comparing the results between the two. On top of that, you just look at your S-meter today and you go to antenna, the new antenna tomorrow, and you look at your S-meter again. Well, that's one data point on one day. You better wait a little bit and make the measurements on multiple days and maybe even more than one season. I mean, the way your antenna behaves in summertime and wintertime could be very different because of its angle of radiation, because of its polarization that it favors, and so on. And for so darn many years before Mel came along with his loop antennas, we have all been naively ignoring Faraday rotation. How come we hear so little about it? How come so many people say, when you say the word Faraday rotation, they say, yeah, I've heard it, but what is it? Is it something I got to be concerned about? And the answer is, only 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Should you be concerned with it? If you care about why the signal is going into phase and why your S-meter moves the way it does today versus tomorrow. whenever that signal goes through that ionosphere, which is a mixture of a plasma cloud and Earth's magnetic field, both of which are changing considerably from hour to hour and day to day, you get a lot of change in polarization. It's called Faraday rotation. When you're listening to a foreign broadcast, shortwave signal, and you hear it going into those phases, a significant percentage of that time, the fade is because the signal arrived at your antenna cross-polarized. Sometimes it is skipping over you or under you, so to speak, but sometimes it's arriving with a beautiful signal strength into your backyard, but it's the opposite polarization from what you're tuned to. And if you have two antennas, you can flip back before the, between the two, an awful lot of those shortwave broadcast station fades wouldn't be there. Interesting experiment. I've never read anybody doing that experiment. The closest I know of anyone experimenting with polarization is where 10 years or so ago, I was taking all these trips to the Romare Development Center in Utica, New York, and near Utica, New York. That's where I was staying in Utica. And I had a horizontally polarized square loop antenna on 2 meters on my car and a vertically polarized 5/8 wave whip, both on the roof of my Oldsmobile station wagon. Two transmission lines coming into the passenger compartment and a relay, and I can flip back and forth rapidly between the two when I'm talking to long-haul, two-meter moonbound stations. That was the guy in southern New Jersey. All of a sudden, I'm having trouble thinking of his name and call letters, but he got it. Alan Katz is one of them. This is the other guy in southern New Jersey, a big two-meter and 432 man, moonbound man. Not as big a moonbound. A guy in southern New Jersey, K2, Russ is his first name, can't think of his last name, a computer expert, he just recently moved anyhow. He's got this 2 meter moonbound, two meter moonbound array. He would aim it at the horizon, he would aim it at my automobile as I'm driving down the New York State Thruway, as I'm going from Long Island to Utica. And when I'm driving across Route 80 on the Thruway, up north of Albany and out to the west toward Utica, I'm close to 200 miles airline distance from him, and I'm holding a sideband QSO with him. 180 watts in my car, kilowatt on his end. He had a big antenna on his end. But on those long-haul QSOs, I would flip back and forth between horizontal and vertical. I couldn't see any difference. The fade rate between the two was the same. Until I was at a scenic overlook. When I go up to a high location of a scenic overlook, and I would listen to Russ on horizontal polarization, he was 10 or 15 dB stronger than vertical. But when I got down into the valley of the thruway, and I'm driving along those canyons, and the signal is getting to me by all kinds of scatter, there was no polarization left, per se. I could listen on either antenna, and he sounded the same. So that's what I experienced on VHF. On HF, something very similar is taking place when that signal goes through the ionosphere. It's taking place at a slower rate, but it's continuously rolling in polarization. And we seem to have all ignored that all these years when we're comparing antennas. And it's one of the significant variables, in my opinion. Back to you, Mel, K2RIW.
WB2XWW.
Go ahead, Howie.
See, I've always noticed this. I've always found slopers or antennas that were in between vertical and horizontal work the best. As a kid, I used to make inverted Vs or slopers from, you know, at 45-degree angles up on my roof. And I actually got better results that way, you know, listening on 10 or 15 or whatever, or even 11 meters. So that just proves that when you have an antenna in between, it's DB from the vertical to horizontal. So whatever direction it still takes to get to your antenna, you're getting the best of all worlds.
Sounds reasonable. Nice thing about an inverted V is that it has a huge advantage over an ordinary horizontal dipole. The dipole you see in the diagrams of all the books that we're supposed to build is really a kind of a mediocre antenna. If you take that dipole at the original altitude, leave the center of that altitude, but take the two ends of the dipole and bring it closer to the ground, common sense would lead you to believe, hey, the average altitude of the antenna has decreased. The performance should decrease. Good common sense. Wrong. Because the ends of the dipole now slope down, the nulls you used to have off the end disappear. When you look at that antenna, that inverted V broadside, In other words, if it's set up as a north-south inverted V antenna, and it radiates best east and west it is a purely horizontally polarized antenna. When you look at it from the south or you look at it from the north, it is a purely vertically polarized antenna. It has no null. It has a horizontal null, north and south, but not vertical. It has a vertical null, east and west, but not horizontal. There's a little bit of everything. So lowering the tips of the dipole to convert it from a full height, straight out dipole, lowering the tips to make it an inverted V increases the performance. Ain't that crazy? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, very good. All right. So, like I say, you've got to experiment with your antenna and don't condemn it after one or two contacts. You've got to give it, especially HF antennas, give them a good, good testing and get some ideas of how you can possibly improve them, but, you know, don't give up on them, as Dick says. Anytime, you know, they will perform over a period of time quite well. And one or two tests is not surely not any kind of criteria for judging an antenna. Okay, so I guess we sort of covered that, Dick. Do you want to look at any more, or you've had enough for tonight?
BZI question.
BZI, I think it was. Go ahead, Edward. Eddie.
Oh, yes, thank you, Dick. Thanks a lot. This is my call. You know, I have a radio, a Yaesu dual bander. I have the FT7800 dual band, a 440, 2 meter, the one I'm using right now. And I have not purchased a base station antenna for it. I'm going to purchase one for the mobile, but I'm hearing this, and I think it's an excellent idea to ask you for pushing me in the right direction on. I have here a stainless steel whip, which is 63 inches long. And I have about five magnet mounts for the mobile, but I also have some other connectors that I can use to put on a pole on the chimney. And I was thinking I could make a 440 or a 2 meter whip, you know, with the right length, but I never investigated it. I don't know how to make a dual band. And I'm hearing this, what an amazing thing to get that V dual band going. Cause sounds like we're in an upside down world. I never heard that before. I'd please like you to comment on how can I get me started off in the right direction on getting a dual band up. Even with that V schematic, the way you're mentioning it right now, some idea in that way. Thank you. Over.
Eddie, I've got a question for you. I'm not going to answer your question first. You're going to answer your question for me first. I think you live in Queens Village. You're 25 miles from me. You're not happy with the antenna you're using yet. Maybe it's not high enough. Maybe it's not a dual bander. And I think you're using an FT7800. How in the world are you pegging my S-meter on the input frequency? How high is your antenna, the one you're using right now? How many watts are you putting into it? And how the hell are you pegging my S-meter over that 30-mile range? Back to you, Eddie.
Oh, okay. Right now, I'm in Babylon at 37 on the southern today. This is my other GPH. And the antenna's on a 20, 30 foot high. And I'm using a hamster. I was couple of years ago, the ham stick. That ham stick. The question. And I'm pretty happy with the ham stick, you know. But, I brought up the wattage a little bit on the radio. Because I'm looking at the new radar I got on my birthday. I'm looking at trying to figure out if I can go high, low on the modulation. I got to look to the cat. I'm looking to the operating manual. Over to this thing.
Okay, that explains it. I'm on 300 foot land with 100 feet of tower, and even though my Yagi 14 element antenna is aimed at Glen Oaks right now, Queens, where the repeater is located, and you're off to one side of my my Yagi. Babylon is only one town away from me. It's one and a half towns away from me, directly south. And when I look south, I probably can, with a good set of binoculars on the top of my tower, I probably can see your wife's house. So that explains it. You're in my backyard, radio-wise. That's why it's so strong. Now, when it comes to dual-band antennas, every antenna will resonate at more than one frequency. A simple dipole that's a half wavelength long, does it resonate at any other frequency? Well, if I've got a good enough antenna tuner, I can make your dipole resonate at every frequency, all the way up the band and down the band. In other words, let's assume I put up a dipole for 80 meters, 135 feet long. If I want to, I can use it on 160 if I've got a real sturdy antenna tuner. The antenna would be pretty low, probably around 5 ohms of resistive reactance at 160 meters, which is an 80 meter dipole. And the reactance is going to be probably capacitive 2,000 ohms. But that's matchable. And you can make that into a pretty good antenna at 160. Not perfect, but good enough. When I tune the antenna at 3.5 megs and I use it at 4.0, it's going to have a 2.5-to-1, 3-to-1 Biswell standing wave ratio. With a good antenna tuner, I can accommodate that. I can decide I want to use the antenna to listen to WWV at 5 megacycles. There it's way out of resonance. The antenna may be 170 ohms resistive and 4,000 ohms inductive reactance, inductive reactance. But with a good antenna tuner, I can tune it. So what frequency does the antenna work on? That 80 meter dipole? Any frequency I want it to. However, at a couple of harmonically related frequencies, it starts coming back into a good match even before I use the antenna tuner. If I use it on the third harmonic frequency, 20 meters, it probably will have a 2.5-to-1 standing wave ratio. Not bad. Usable. So on all the third harmonic related, in other words, third harmonic, fifth harmonic, seventh harmonic, it'll work pretty nicely. It comes back into resonance again, even before I use the antenna tuner. That's one way of looking at antennas in multiple bands. The next step is that if I put traps in the dipole, I can string that 80-meter dipole and put tuning networks at a couple of specific locations along the dipole, and I now can make a dipole that works in 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10. And that's a design you'll find in the ARRO antenna book. When it comes to a 2-meter and 440 antenna, let me drop. There are ways of wrapping the wire with a coil in just the right spot. There are ways of impedance matching it at the bottom of the mag mount, if it was a dual band mag mount antenna from your car, and the antenna can give rather good performance on both 2 meters and 440. It's a matter of the physical design and the electronics you put inside. So how to make an antenna work on more than one frequency at once? You can find articles on how to do that, or you can choose a good brand name, write a check, and the problem goes away. You buy the antenna, you install it, and you're happy with it. And which is the right way to go is your choice. To figure out how an antenna works on the fundamental frequency and make it work well and understand it, a medium amount of study is required. Antennas are not easy. We're all confused on them. That's one of the main subjects why Mel and Dick on their TechNet discuss more antenna subjects than any other subject. It's not easy. And the way the books are written on the subject, is okay, but it could be better. It could be more understandable. So once you understand to some degree how an ordinary antenna works on the fundamental frequency, with a little bit more study, you'll find out how to make it work on more than one frequency at once, to make it a dual band or a tri-band antenna. And in theory, you can tell by that trapped dipole, you can make an antenna work on all five bands at once, 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10. And you could probably make it work on 162, 160 also, with just a little bit more slot. So there's no easy answer to explain how does an antenna work on more than one band at once. I don't have an easy answer for that. Maybe Mel does. Maybe he's done some more work on multi-band antennas. I'll turn it over to him and see what he's got to answer this one. K2KEY, KQRIW.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. Well, as far as HF goes, multi-band antennas, of course, many of the amateur radio, most of the amateur radio bands in the HF have harmonic relationships. So if you could actually cut an antenna for 80 meters and go right through 10 meters with it. Of course, again, suggestion of using a tuner to pick up the differences, slight differences of the problem of slight, you know, mismatching at different bands, you go to different bands. But this is the beautiful part of amateur radio, that most of the frequencies that we have are related to one another. I guess that's the best way to explain it, Dick. Over.
Yeah, I also made a mistake. An 80-meter antenna, 20 meters, is the fourth harmonic frequency. Multiplied by 4. 3.5 times 4, I think, is 14 megs, if I got the math right. Double the frequency you're on. On 40 meters, quadruple the frequency, you're on 20 meters. So that's not a good relationship. A 40-meter dipole does work beautifully on 15 meters. 7 megacycles versus 21 megacycles, 3-to-1 ratio, that works very well. So with traps in the dipole, you can make it work on as many bands as you want. By the fan dipole technique, the magic of the RF going down the transmission line is it will choose the antenna that has the good impedance. If you've got a fan dipole on 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10, and that signal is coming down the transmission line, if it's an 80-meter signal, it'll choose the 80-meter antenna. All the others have a high standing wave ratio, will absorb only a very small percentage of the energy, and 95% of the energy will go into the 80-meter dipole. And a similar thing happens on the other band. So fan dipole, trap dipole, these are some of the ways of making multi-frequency antennas. The microwave guys have got ways of using waveguides at higher harmonic frequencies, and they can make a feed horn for their parabolic dish antenna that works on 1296 and 2304 simultaneously. There's even one patch antenna design that works on 3 or 4 microwave bands at once as a feed horn. So I didn't say it's easy. I don't have a couple of simple words telling you how this comes about. But once you understand how an antenna works on the fundamental frequency, it's just a little bit harder to figure out how it can work on more than one band at once. As long as the radiating system, consisting of feed line, impedance matching network, and antenna, as long as the radiating system resonates on your two bands, it will radiate on your two bands. You just have to force it to resonate on each one of those. And the next question you should have, some guys eventually have, is what happens if I've got some kind of a power combining device so that I'm hitting the antenna on both bands at once? I got my wife singing into the microphone on 2 meters, on the 2-meter transmitter, and coupled to the dual band antenna. And I'm talking into the microphone on the 440 transmitter, and that's also being coupled to the dual band antenna. And will the antenna radiate both bands independently, simultaneously? And the answer is yes. The antenna doesn't know the difference. The guy listening to you on 440, listening to me on 440, or the other person listening to my wife on 2 meters will not know the difference. It will work simultaneously on two frequencies. That sounds too good to be true, but I've done it. It works. I know we haven't really answered your question as to what brand you should buy. And by the way, that's one of the things I think Mel and I should discuss pretty soon, and that is, we ought to repeat, Mel, what kind of questions we will handle and what kind of questions we will not handle. Mel is pretty patient, but you guys have been pushing it pretty far. For you to list every piece of test equipment and every piece of ham radio equipment that's in your shack and ask Mel, how can I best use this, that's not appropriate. It's too vague a question. It's like saying, will I be happier if I marry a blonde, a brunette, or a brownhead lady? A lot of variables in both cases. You can't answer that question. If you ask him, should I buy a Kenwood model so-and-so versus a Linko model so-and-so versus an Icon model such-and-such, not a fair question. We will not suggest what brand name. If there's somebody that builds a really bad piece of equipment, where everybody who's ever bought one thought he's being cheated, and every time you plug it in, it blows up, and it only lasts on the air for 10 minutes and it does something bad, yeah, we'll say, don't buy that one. We'll do that. But when it comes to the subtle differences between old and new, used and brand new equipment with all kinds of horns and whistles, and which one should you buy, and compare the prices on rigs and antennas, that's not a fair question. It sounds like a fair question, it's not. Every new, let me drop this.
PB2HWW to comment, Dick.
How we recognize every new ham radio operator enters into a very confusing world. He opens up the catalogs, he opens up QST magazine, he sees ads for 40 different rigs, and he says to himself, how in the world can I choose the best one? I don't want to waste my money. I want to get one that's good enough. I want to get one that I'm going to be happy with for 3 years. I don't want to have something that's okay for a week, and after that I don't like it anymore. How can I choose the best rig? That's a tough one. There's no good answer for that one. The best you can do is decide you're going to buy new or used. You can save a whole lot of money used, and with people like Andy, the Bay2CDL, on this particular repeater, who knows how to repair anything, knows how to test anything. You meet him at a tune-up clinic at any one of the Limark flea markets, and he will test your piece of equipment free of charge, set the deviation, tell you how well it's working, measure the power output, and so on, measure the frequency, accuracy, and stability, and you can find out if that particular used piece of equipment is the one you're happy with. So you can save yourself a whole lot of money by used equipment if you don't have to have every one of those functions. Sometimes the new rigs with every one of those functions are a pain in the neck to use because you can't get to the right menu and to the right selection key and so on. Keep it simple. One of my favorite rigs when it comes to 2-meter handy talking, the one I carry up the tower with me as a safety piece of equipment so that I can always communicate with the ground, so I can always holler mayday if something goes wrong and I want somebody to pass me up a tool, put it on the end of the rope so I can haul it up. I don't want to haul my body up and down the tower. I spent 5 hours up my tower Wednesday. And having radio equipment and radio communication from the top of the tower to the people down on the ground is very important to me. I carry an IC2AT 1985 rig with a lanyard on it that's connected into the harness, the safety harness, so that it can't be dropped. And a bunch of tape wrapped around the battery so it can't disconnect from the radio. That radio is wired to my body. That radio has very simple thumbnail wheel switches on the top. I can easily dial it from frequency A to frequency B. I know where I am. I can do it in the dark. I don't have to have a display, a liquid crystal display that I have to see. I can hit the darn thing with my tool and it doesn't break the display and I lose that function. I have dropped that radio from the top of my tower on 2 occasions and it survived. It smashed the battery. On one of those occasions, it came down to blacktop, what would you call that, macadam or asphalt, and shattered the daylights out of the battery. I'm still using that radio. Nice and simple, very reliable. I dial it to my favorite frequency with the thumb wheel switches on the top. And I've got continuous communication on the ground. That solves my problem. Any brand new ham being told that he would be happy with a piece of 1985 handy-talkie equipment will say, what in the world are you smoking? from me. From me, it works. Howie, I know you got some comments on all this. WB2HWW, go ahead. UIW will get to you after Howie. Go ahead, Howie.
I don't think it's inappropriate to make comments about equipment. None of us are making a living off of selling equipment. Maybe it would be inappropriate for a couple of guys on the repeater who are directly in the business. I'm not going to mention their names. But there are, you know, I'm going to give an example. A lot of guys are buying a radio. What is, can I mention a radio, Dick? And I just want to give an example. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, we're not against mentioning brand names. And I'll explain that later. Go ahead, Howie.
This is two radios out there. There's the Yaesu 8900 and there's the Yaesu 857. A lot of guys are running the 8900, which is a quad-band FM radio, 10 meters, 6 meters, 2 meters, and 440. The radio has a problem. It has only 2.5 kcs of deviation on 10 meters. The radio goes for around $400 to $500. Go out and buy the 857 from the same manufacturer for around $699 or $700. And that radio gives you 160 through 440, gives you all modes. I'd rather go buy the radio, the 857, which gives you all modes, and go out and spend almost the same money or a couple hundred less and just get FM, and a lot of guys are doing that. I think it's appropriate to discuss ins and outs. You know what? A lot of guys think the more money they spend, the better the radio. I really don't think it makes that big of a difference. Yeah, you're going to get better filtering. But the most important part of the shack is your antenna. The guys who are buying the R7, those are the 7000. A couple of guys in this repeater that have it. I don't like the 7000. I think it's over-tech. I think these radios with too many menus are crazy. So I don't think there's anything wrong with you guys actually getting down it. You don't have to say it, but you can give the good points and negatives and explain. Because the average guy who just gets his license is bewildered. He looks at 0.1 microvolt. He looks at, okay, this radio has 100 dB, the dynamic range. To a lot of people, that doesn't mean anything. Sometimes the simpler the radio, the better off you are. Sometimes, like an 847 might be better than, the 8900 or whatever, one of the newer $10,000 radios. So, my opinion is, I'm just giving an example, Dick, of these two radios. One is the Yaesu 8900, which is the quad band. And you can go out for a couple hundred more and get an all mode rig and all band radio. I'd rather spend $200 more and get a radio that covers 160 through 440. Dick, back to you.
Okay, let me let it drop for a second. When it comes to us discussing radios during the sickness, our favorite brand names, I mean, my favorite base station 2-meter all mode radio is an old fashioned Conker. Kenwood TS711A. That's what you're listening to right now. I just love that thing. Beautiful synthesizer. Not super compact. Doesn't have a lot of horns and whistles. Only got 30 memories. But it suits my needs very nicely. I like the fact that on the front panel, it's got a variable knob where I can make it go from 1 watt to 30 watts transmit power in any mode. So I can make it very nicely adjust to any of my transverters for 432, 1296, 10 gigahertz type stuff. Beautiful rig to me. 1985 vintage. You can buy them used for some pretty nice prices, and they've been out of manufacture for a long time. So for us to get together on the air and discuss our favorite rigs, perfectly appropriate. I like this one, I hate that one. Perfectly appropriate. We hams, who are not in the business of selling radios, discussing what we like and what we don't like, and who's got the best one today, and who's too complicated, and who's not user-friendly, perfectly appropriate. But for somebody to mail Mel 50 emails where 30 of them say, should I buy this or should I buy that? That is not appropriate for him, in my opinion. I'm going to turn it over to him and an opinion for him to add to that. But to say that, gee, I've got X number of dollars, I'm only a school teacher, I don't have a lot of money, and I'm trying to decide, I'm new to ham radio, and should I buy this or should I buy that? That is not a question that ham, that the bell should be hit with, in my opinion. To get on the air where we each tell what we're using and what we like, and it's a group discussion, beautiful subject. But for one poor guy to be hit with 40 brand names, a brand new rig, some of which he's not familiar with because they've only been around for 2 months, and his group, even though he's the president of the Kings County Radio Club, and he's talking to a lot of people who use a lot of radios, it doesn't mean he's familiar with every one of these and can make an intelligent decision for that particular guy. And if he tells that guy, yeah, you're thinking of buying a $700 radio, and you buy one that's $900, it's a little bit better, and the specs sound good, but I'm not familiar with it, he's taking a hell of a lot of risk to make that kind of a suggestion. I think that's unfair. You shouldn't ask him, what antenna should I buy? You shouldn't ask him, what rig should I buy? Maybe Mel wants to answer that. K2KUI.
K2KUI, don't?
Yeah, I know. We're going to get to you. Mel first. Go ahead.
Just make a brief little carriage even further than that. They asked me which dealer to deal with. Who's the most reliable dealer and all. And on and on. I just can't comment on the price range and the reliability of the product. You don't have any idea, Dick. It goes on and on. And it's insistent. You know, it repeats back over and over. And when I don't respond, I tell them I can't really respond and all. I get back, in some cases, I've gotten back some very so-called colorful remarks over.
All right.
KCQUIW, if you're back, fortunately, we can listen to you right now. That was Joe, KC2QIW. Joe, you don't have your PL turned on. Beyond 11 o'clock at night, this repeater goes into the PL required mode. And so Joe is a DJ. He likes simple radios with user-friendly and these complicated radios with 40 menus. I know where he's coming from. When you look at the advertisements for a rig and you look at the list of all of the features it has, it's very enticing to say, gee, I'd like to buy that rig with this one for that many dollars. It's got 30 features, and this one for almost the same number of dollars. It's got 40 features. Boy, it looks like you're getting more money with the 40-feature radio. It may be a hell of a lot harder to use. The biggest investment you make with a new computer, a new handheld calculator, or a new piece of equipment, the biggest investment you make is the amount of time it takes you to figure out how to use the damn thing, how to get familiar with it. That's the biggest investment you make. The dollars you invest may not be relevant. That's part of what I think Joe was saying. Mel, we're getting awful close to the bewitching hour where they're going to shut us off. This was TechNet number 1150. You guys have just wasted 3 hours of your life, or 4 hours of your life, listening to this jazz. We think we're going to be back next week. Please don't hit Mel with these questions where you ask him brand names, model numbers, and who you should buy it from. That's not appropriate. Whether or not we should use a piece of RGAU or a piece of a 300-ohm twin lead for a particular antenna, that's appropriate. Real technical question. But brand names and model numbers for an individual to make a suggestion for you, not appropriate. For us to all come together and discuss our favorite rigs, the ones we like and we don't like, on the air, very appropriate. Those are series of opinions on my part. K2KEY, go ahead, Mel. Yeah.
Hey, very good. Very fine, Dick. And, yeah, you're 100% right. That carries even a lot further than that. Besides the recommending products, or recommending service people, recommending methods of service, places to buy, purchase materials, things, on and on and on. I really don't have any, you know, direct answers. So I am not being, you know, a couple that, you know, stuck up. It's just I don't have answers. That's it. That's not the point. I'm not trying to be, you know, hard person to deal with. It's just that I haven't got the answers. That's it. So, okay, we'll do it again next week. Take care, everybody. Try to stay dry. I guess we got a lot of rain coming this week. And we'll look forward to doing this again next week. This is K2KEY, 73 for all.
And when Mel says he doesn't know, that's not being stuck up. A smart person knows something about what he doesn't know. A smart person will say, I don't know. If he really doesn't know. And I, for one, am completely unfamiliar with the brand new brands of radios, all the horns and whistles and features and whatever. I've got very little knowledge of that. When I buy a radio with a flea market or internet or eBay or whatever, I buy function. I don't buy beauty. And in many cases, I'm not even buying features. This particular thing... Bye-bye, you guys. Bye-bye.